Welcome to the Midterm Matters podcast from the University of Delaware Center for Political Communication. This podcast is part of the Center for Political Communication's upcoming National Agenda Series, Midterm Matters, addressing the importance of voter and civic engagement in midterm elections, as well as campaign strategy, news coverage, polling, and more. I'm your host, Delaware Public Media News Director Tom Byrne. We are joined today by the UD Center for Political Communications Associate Director and National Agenda Series Director, Dr. Lindsay Hoffman, who teaches communication and political science at UD, and from the UD Department of Political Science and International Relations, Associate Professor Dr. Phil Jones, whose research focuses on voting, campaigns and elections, public opinion, and political communication. I thank you both for being with us on the Midterm Matters podcast. How you doing?
Great.
Good. Thank you for having us.
Well, let's start with maybe kind of more of a kind of global type of issue. We're about 5 months out from the November midterm general election, and I'm curious if you guys feel like any issues are rising to the forefront. I mean, there seems to be a lot of different possibilities here. We just saw another school shooting in Santa Fe, so perhaps guns, foreign policy with the perhaps upcoming U.S.-North Korea summit and the decision to pull out of the Iran nuclear deal. Recently, the Trump administration kind of brought abortion back into play by seeking to revive a Reagan-era mandate banning federally funded family planning clinics from referring women for abortions or sharing space with abortion providers. And of course, there's the ongoing Trump-Russia collusion investigation. So I kind of throw
an investigation into the investigation.
Exactly. So I guess what I'm wondering is this election likely to be about any one or two issues at some point?
I mean, I think it's totally different from any other midterm that I can think of, just because there's so many different issues. And I think that, you know, what's going to happen is sort of what issues stay at the top. And I think, you know, I talked to my students about, particularly after the Parkland shooting, and all those young students who have managed, kind of despite all odds, to keep that story in the news. You know, when we look at, like, the issue attention cycle, you would predict, this is this theory that you would predict after a while people become enraged, they become upset about it, and then it just sort of fades away. And so what I'm fascinated by is following that particular story, particularly in the wake of Santa Fe, and and you know, who knows if we will have others before the election. But I think for me, that's the fascinating one to watch, because we have these young people who are motivated to speak out on Twitter and on social media, but now they're also registering to vote, and they're talking about voting in midterms, which is not something that young people typically are engaged in.
So
yeah, I mean, so I think I come at this from a slightly different point as a political scientist. I mean, the number one issue is always the president, right? So the president's party always loses seats in a midterm election, more so when the president is unpopular. And essentially, when you look back at past midterms, what the party that's trying to win the House, or the party that's trying to take over the House, does is make it all about the president. Right, so 2010, the Republicans did not have an issue agenda. And, you know, you can go back and look at the news, and there's all these stories about they need an issue agenda, they need to find an issue. Nah, they just had to wait for Obama to be unpopular. 2006, Democrats were in the same place. You make, you know, they had issues that they tried to run on, minimum wage, healthcare, the usual education, sort of core Democratic issues. But their number one selling point was Bush was unpopular as president. I mean, so to some extent,
the issues don't matter?
I think to some extent the issues don't matter, except in as much as they affect the president's approval rating. So I think the issue is going to be Trump and how close is the incumbent seen to Trump more than any particular issue. That would be my guess.
Guys, I'm curious, but one of the reasons I asked is recently our political reporter Sarah Mueller talked to Senator Chris Coons, who's not up for re-election this year, and he said what he hears most from his constituents is about healthcare and the opioid crisis. And I guess that kind of got me thinking, like, do issues like that, that maybe perhaps affect more people directly, have more resonance that maybe we don't think about that kind of as an undercurrent, as opposed to maybe these kind of shiny object issues that we hear from week to week? Is there a sense that maybe there are some issues like that out there that we're not seeing underneath the surface of it?
I mean, I think that there could be, right? And the opioid crisis would seem to be something that is affecting a lot of people across the country, is getting little sort of politicized play. Like, neither party, I think, has a particular advantage or even agenda for how to deal with this. At the same time, right, there's a long trend in American or public opinion generally of people not connecting what they see as personal issues to things that the government is doing, right? So to the the extent that people don't think of or think of the opioid crisis as a sort of personal issue, as something that affects families, but that government isn't really involved in, mm-hmm. it's probably hard for them to make that link.
Well, and, you know, I think you bring up a good point that at this point, neither party really owns the issue.
Right.
But if we are to look at traditional issue ownership, we know that Democrats tend to own healthcare and things like that. So mm-hmm. I think that there's a possibility if Democratic candidates jump on this and come up with some real solutions to it and make it their issue, mm-hmm. That there's a real possibility there. I mean, in the 2016 election, we saw Republicans talking a lot about the opioid crisis. And to me, I was thinking, wow, they're going to take over this issue. But I still don't think anybody owns it yet.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the fact that it is pretty widespread, so it's affecting states that are seen as blue states, states that are seen mm-hmm. as red states, started largely under a Democratic President Obama, continued under a Republican President Trump, makes it hard for the parties to make this a partisan issue, I think, as well.
Yeah.
So as we start looking at some of these issues and the possibilities of how voters might react, we have had some primaries recently, including up the road in Pennsylvania. Have we learned anything from these initial votes in the election cycle about where things could be heading, or where what is the mood of the electorate at this point?
Well, I think, you know, I actually live up the way in Pennsylvania, and it was really interesting to me to see the redistricting and how the candidates that I was looking at voting for suddenly changed partway through. So I think the 5th district was a really interesting one to look at because of all the women and the mm-hmm. First-time women candidates running and how supportive these women in several of these primaries that we've seen so far, how supportive the losing women are of the mm-hmm. winning women. Mm-hmm. So it becomes sort of a women's coalition. And I think that's, to me, that's the interesting thing to watch with all these primaries is both established women who have been in politics and women who are coming into it for the first time are really kind of joining forces.
Phil, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's right. There's certainly been a surge of women candidates on the Democratic side. Nothing on the Republican side different from previous years, but there are far more women running for office. And I think there are far more women running for office in places where they can win, right? So these are not just first-time women candidates running in places where the Democrats are going to get wiped out in the fall. These are running like PA5, right? These women are running and winning primaries in places where they can actually win the general election. So I think that suggests, right, sort of a change in what Congress looks like potentially mm-hmm. after the election.
Well, and I mean, recently we saw the Georgia primary, the mm-hmm. Texas primary mm-hmm. for governor, the first African-American woman mm-hmm. to potentially ever be governor in the country, in this history of this country is kind of fascinating. You know, we know 1992 was the year of the woman, but it was generally largely white women from what I understand, or yeah. Was it more diverse?
I think Carol Moseley Brown from Illinois was elected that year, but
Yeah,
pretty limited.
If we're talking about one person.
Yeah, right. If that's the only one you can remember.
That's the only one I can remember, and I suspect I can remember her because she stood out from all of her white colleagues.
Exactly. Probably. But I think this year what we're seeing is, you know, African-American women, Latino women, transgender candidates, mm-hmm. So a lot of different types of diversity, and that's pretty exciting to see that change. You see so many pictures. I saw one the other day of, I think it was a senatorial committee meeting with representatives from China about some technology issue, mm-hmm. and it was all old white men on one side of the table and all the young, kind of hip-looking Chinese technology experts on the other side of the table. So it'll be interesting to see if that we do see that shift in the kinds of people, the kinds of faces that are on the Hill.
I want to talk a little. Okay, I'm sorry, Phil.
Yeah, I mean, so just to pick up on the Georgia primary for governor where Stacey Abrams won recently. I mean, this is a really big shift in Georgia politics. So she was running against another state legislator, Stacey Evans.
The Battle of the Stacey's.
The Battle of the Stacey's, which irritated them both to no end, as I can imagine, right? As somebody with a very common name, I can imagine.
Right, well, and you don't hear, like, if there's two Johns, like, the bat,
Right.
Yeah, so it irritated them to no belief. But their pitch was very different. So Stacey Evans' pitch was sort of what the Democrats in the South have done or tried to do for decades now, which is say, I'm going to run as a moderate to conservative, going to try and pick up some Republican votes and hope I can get to 50%. And so Democrats in Georgia get 45% pretty routinely, no matter how good or bad their candidate is, no matter how much money they have. You know, it's they're sort of capped at 45% with that strategy. The Stacey Abrams strategy is, I'm not going to appeal to Republicans. I'm going to try and turn out people who don't usually vote, particularly minorities, particularly women, particularly young people. And that, right, if she pulls that off in the fall, that's not just a shift in who you're electing, that's a shift in who's showing up and who's taking part.
Absolutely. I think she said that's she wants to sign up, register about, what is it, 800,000 voters before 2020?
Yeah, and she's been doing this for a few years. She's had like this voter project in Georgia for a few years, and they're getting close to a million, I think, which is crazy.
Which takes me where I wanted to go next anyway, which is turnout. I mean, we've seen in a lot of these primaries the turnout was low, which is typical of both primaries and midterms. Mm-hmm. But I'm hearing both you talk about changing perhaps the dynamic. Will young people be more engaged and turn out? Because there's a lot more women and diverse women involved, will there be a greater turnout? Mm-hmm. Is there even an effort by some candidates to tap into greater turnout? Do you feel like there is a chance, at least in some of these races, to kind of change that kind of persistent low midterm turnout narrative?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, There are a lot of Trump effects. I think we can refer to it as these first few months or years, it seems like, of this presidency. But I can say what I've seen anecdotally from my students is a level of engagement that I haven't seen before. Mm-hmm. I think the Obama effect was a somewhat of an apathy among young people. I think they weren't really paying attention. Now the kind of minutiae and sort of what they dig into and the questions that they ask are really detailed, and they're very interested. I'm working with a student group that is bringing multiple voter registration efforts to mm-hmm. campus. We're going to be doing a challenge. It's called the All-In Challenge, where universities compete with each other to get the highest voter registration and voting rate. So I think definitely on the college campus, at least here at the University of Delaware, we're seeing a renewed interest where when I first came to this campus, it was a relatively apathetic place in terms of politics. So I really do think we're going to see a young mm-hmm. turnout.
Yeah, and this and the initiative that Lindsay's talking about is completely student-driven, right? So it's not the result of, you know, a class project. This is not professors sort of starting something up. This really is driven totally by the students. They have an all-student board, all-student mm-hmm. management.
Yeah, they're working closely with the Biden Institute yeah. and with the Center for Political Communication yep. to have all sorts of, we have several events planned. And, you know, the big thing for students at the University of Delaware is understanding how to vote absentee, because a lot mm-hmm. of our students mm-hmm. are not Delawareans. So that's going to be the big thing, the big hurdle to get our students through.
Should campaigns be focusing a little bit more on maybe changing their approach because of some of these things we're talking about? I mean, sometimes campaigns get accused of fighting the last war. Mm-hmm. I mean, is there a danger that they may be a little bit behind the curves, at least some of them, in looking at this?
You mean in thinking like young people don't vote? Why bother with that?
Or that, and also just okay. You know, we know that there's kind of a ceiling to midterm mm-hmm. turnout, and mm-hmm. you know maybe they shouldn't maybe limit their horizon to what they can perhaps tap into, whether it be young people, whether it be women, whether it be mm-hmm. any other constituency.
Well, I mean, I think the Stacey Abrams model is clearly working. Mm-hmm. It worked in Georgia, and if other candidates followed that path and sort of made their effort not to maybe go around campaigning, but to go around getting people registered to vote, mm-hmm. That might have a bigger impact than like kind of like Phil was saying that maybe the issues of the day, mm-hmm. Just getting actual people to the voting booth.
Yeah, it's a very different model of campaigning, right? So it's a model where you say, I'm not going to try and persuade anybody. I'm not going to try and persuade them to vote for me over my opponent. I'm not going to try and persuade them on any issue that they might care about. What I'm going to do is find people who I know already support me, but are unlikely to show up. And I'm going to basically drive them to the polls. And that's very different. It's a very different kind of campaigning. I think it's a different kind of politics, and not necessarily a good one either, from the sort of let's go after the moderates, let's go after the independents, let's find people who might be persuaded to switch from one party to another. Those are very different strategies.
And does it make more sense in a midterm because there is a larger group of people who are unlikely to show up?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. So if, you know, average midterm turnout is around 30%, that means 7 out of 10 people don't show up. All you have to do is find the 2 out of that 10 who already support you but are ambivalent or bored with politics or don't know there's an election. election or aren't registered, all you've got to do is find them, make it easy for them, and get them to the polls.
I did want to just kind of change gears a little bit here.
Sure.
Center for Political Communication funded some work on public opinion toward transgender rights. It just came out. You all are involved in that. So yeah. I wanted to take the opportunity to kind of tap into what you know and what you can tell us a little bit about. First, just tell us a little bit about what you found and I guess specifically about what it could mean for potential transgender candidates since we're talking elections.
Sure. Yeah, I'll take the lead on.
Yeah, please, Phil, you were such an instrumental part of this project, but I do want to point out that it was just published recently in Public Opinion Quarterly, mm-hmm. and we're really proud of that work that came out of the CPC.
Yeah, and this is sort of an all-CPC, all-star team. So it's Paul Brewer, Dana Young, who you mm-hmm. had on the last podcast, Jenny Lam, Lindsay, and myself all worked on this. And so this was a national survey trying to assess, well, what do people think about transgender people? What do they think about transgender rights? What do they think about transgender candidates? And I think we find there's a lot of ambivalence out there, a lot of sort of people somewhat on the fence about these issues, but the kinds of things you would expect to predict opinion do, right? So liberals tend to be more supportive than conservatives, Democrats more than Republicans, people who are very religious, less so than, you know, the atheists or secular people. And I think all of that's as expected. There's a couple of really cool, unusual findings. And so one is that how much television you watch strongly predicts how you feel towards transgender people. And so the more TV you watch, the more you're exposed to the media, the more likely you are to think trans people are moral, are happy, are trustworthy.
To have higher attitudes towards them.
Yeah, sort of hold fewer negative stereotypes, feel more positively towards them, which I think is really interesting. And then another interesting finding is that in turn, your views on or your perceptions of trans people, whether you think they're good people or not, really strongly affects whether you think they should be given legal rights. And so I think quite often we have this idea that people, you know, come up with, mm-hmm. should we give legal rights to this group based on, you know, reading the Constitution
or,
you
rationality.
Know, like, rationality, thinking about, you know, what would Thomas Jefferson have done here? And that's just, I mean, just never or very rarely true. Instead, right, if you like trans people as a group, you are good with giving them civil rights. If you don't like them as a group, you are not okay with it.
I think I like that. What would Thomas Jefferson do? I'll put that on a little bracelet, WWTJD.
I mean, I feel like we should say, like, not all of his life choices were good ones.
Good
at this point.
I'm
not sure I would want to follow him.
Good point.
To the
but,
T, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's a cool paper because it it's one of the, I mean, there has been research exploring public opinion towards, about people's attitudes towards transgender people, issues, and candidates. But this employs a whole lot of other correlates and measures mm-hmm. that we haven't really seen before. Mm-hmm. And already it's been, we've all been talking about it on Twitter. We're getting quite an academic conversation recently on Twitter about all the different types of variables and things that we used in this study. So yeah. It's just a good example of the kind of research that can come out of a cross-disciplinary mm-hmm. Relationship with scholars from different disciplines.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And then there's sort of one other thing we found, which is, I think, interesting, if not particularly uplifting, which is that we asked people whether they would support a transgender candidate for office. And so we tried to make it as easy as possible for them to say yes, basically. So we said, what if your party, they'd already told us if they were Democrats or Republicans. And so we said, well, what if your party, let's say it's the Republicans, what if the Republicans nominated a transgender person for office? Would you vote for your party or would you vote for the other party or would you sit it out, basically? And so when they're asked, we asked them about just regular cisgender people, and then we asked them about a transgender candidate. And so when you ask them about regular people, voters, about 70% of them say, oh yeah, I'll vote for my party. That's a no-brainer, right? Mm-hmm. Like whatever the election coming up is, whatever the candidate, yeah, sure, I'll vote for them. When we tell them that the candidate is transgender, that support drops to about 35%. Mm. So it drops in half. And so remember, right, this is your same party, right, the thing that predicts every election we have going on mm. right now, the thing that in a polarized era should be the only bit of information most voters care about, right, just being told that the candidate was trans really halved that support immediately. And what I think, I could talk for hours about this.
I know. No, I could listen to you talk for hours about it.
What I think is really interesting about this experiment is that finding was true no matter the type of person we asked. So you might think, oh, that's definitely going to be true for conservatives, but not for liberals. Nope. Liberals and conservatives disliked the trans candidate. Democrats and Republicans disliked them. People who were very morally traditional disliked them, as did people who were sort of morally progressive. This was largely across the board. Yeah. Wow.
Very, very
interesting. Dislike for trans candidates.
Well, I'm going to move on to some more local issues. And just if people are interested in learning more about that, how is there a place they can go to kind of learn more about that study relatively easily?
Well, it, you know, the thing with academic publishing.
You can pass on that question if you'd like. I would give you the opportunity.
There's a paywall in for access to these things. But we've certainly been talking about it on Twitter, and I think people could reach out to us on that venue for questions.
Okay. Yeah. Do you want to say your handle?
Oh yeah, at LHHOFF.
And mine is at Phil E. Jones, all one word. We'd be happy to talk to you about the paper, maybe even share a copy illicitly outside the paywall.
Shh.
So I want to do more with some local issues. Yeah. And looking at Delaware's midterm races, we've talked about this before. The biggest one would appear to be the attorney general's race. And as yet, no Republican running, but there are four Democrats vying to replace Matt Dehn, who decided not to run again. What I wanted to bring up this time is that, you know, recently the ACLU of Delaware and some others formed a coalition trying to put the spotlight on this race. They're trying to familiarize voters with who's running, where they stand. And I guess the question I have for you is, how tall a task is that to kind of get people invested in the Delaware Attorney General's race in the midterm cycle?
Yeah.
Right. In the primary.
In
a primary that's in September.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, of course, in some cases that might make it even more relevant because it's so close to the general. Mm-hmm. I think it's a role that not a lot of people are familiar with. If we're talking about 30% of people showing up to vote generally, they probably have not done a lot of research on attorney general. It's a challenge, I think. But, you know, in some ways, if any state could do it, I think Delaware could, because it's, you know, that's what I've learned since I've come here, is like everyone knows everybody, and you start to talk about these things, and it becomes, it becomes a topic of conversation among the people who live in the state.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and, you know, being a relatively compact, relatively small state, I think also helps, right? You don't need that many votes. You don't need that many people to go into a polling place and vote for you to actually win an election, right? A primary in September with four candidates, or at the moment, four candidates, but quite possibly more, splitting the vote on a weekday. I don't know. How many votes do you think you might need to beat the other candidate? 1,000?
You can probably dig down and figure out, like, what number do I need to hit to actually win this thing?
And I'm sure the ACLU is thinking that and thinking, well, we could spend $50 per vote to get there if we wanted.
Well, and what's interesting to me is that date for the primary has changed, too, because of Rosh Hashanah. So it's going to be on a Thursday, which for people who vote regularly, which would be older people who tend to vote more in these types of elections, that might be a pretty confusing change. It might just reduce turnout overall among everybody.
I was going to say, I mean, it's usually Saturday, Tuesday, and so now you're taking it to a completely different day, which is definitely odd, to say the least.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen a Thursday.
I can't think of one. Yeah.
I mean, other than maybe a school referendum or something like that.
Now, what difference does that ultimately make? I don't know. I mean, we do know that the weather can impact turnout. There are some kind of random things like that. This could be a little interesting, little experiment to see if there's a significant drop in turnout because of the day of the week.
Yeah, although probably less of a change than if they'd moved it to a Saturday, right? I mean, the proportion of people who work on a Tuesday is probably the same as the proportion who work on a Thursday.
Good point.
Fair enough.
If they really wanted to goose turnout, they could have moved it to Saturday.
One of the non-budget stories making headlines in the General Assembly this year, another failed attempt to pass a state equal rights amendment would add a ban on gender-based discrimination to the state constitution. And we've talked a lot about women in this election cycle and women getting more involved and women candidates. But here we have a situation where a women's issue before the General Assembly has kind of hit a wall yet again. State Senate Republicans almost uniformly voting against it after three amendments to the amendment, addressing their concerns that the measure would lead to taxpayer-funded abortions or incarcerating women and men in the same prisons. Those amendments all failed. Then they held the votes, and like I said, only one Republican voted for it. And also what's kind of curious about this is that it passed the House with ease, before getting stuck in the Senate again. Is it surprising, kind of in the current climates, that this has kind of hit this wall again? I mean, if you look at the history of it, it's hit the wall a number of times.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
But one would think that perhaps this would be the atmosphere that this would finally have an opportunity to get the kind of support it needs.
That was my take on it, that this seems like the moment. Seems like we're in a moment. But I think it also, as much of an optimist as I am about, people getting involved in politics and people making, you know, good decisions, I also have to remember that, every day we have a news story that comes out about men in power abusing women regularly. So while on the surface this might seem like the time, this might seem like, okay, we're ready for this, we still have a long ways to go in addressing the kinds of pain and injustice that have been delivered to women for a very long time. So that's still happening. I think we're hopefully at the beginning of a wave of, I think, really bringing women's issues to the fore. But certainly we can see in the Trump White House that that's not on the agenda. And in a lot of cases, particularly given his vice president, the opposite is on the agenda.
I think that's absolutely right, Lindsay. Yeah, I think so. I mean, it strikes me as somebody who's not particularly an expert in this round of the ERA fights, that this is largely a cosmetic issue, right? That this, no state that has ERA has been forced into any of the things that its opponents or proponents say will happen as a result. States that have ERAs in their constitution didn't really see any change before and after. And so to me, the puzzling thing about the Republican almost unified opposition, not quite, to it, is that this really is just a cosmetic thing. And from their point of view, what they probably, you know, if you're a conservative, you probably don't want greater government regulation in general. And the danger is, right, with the Me Too wave that could be coming, that you end, you know, you could have headed it off a little bit by saying, oh, well, we've got an ERA, that should pacify everybody for a bit. Instead, you might end up with some actual serious action being taken against all of the abuse and the discrimination that we keep hearing about every single day.
On the local area, I do want to wrap up with maybe something that's a little bit more, I don't know if I want to say fun, but at least like off the beaten trail a bit, and that's sports betting.
like horses on the, no. that's a track, right?
Yeah, people don't bet on horses on a trail. Will the horse make it up the mountain?
And this is why we're not going to talk specifically about betting and logistics
about
of betting.
I don't know anything about sports.
That's okay.
I don't know anything about betting, but I will admit
to you guys before we started this, I'm kind of a bit of a nerd about this. I covered this a lot when Delaware made a play for full sports betting back in 2008 and 2009. I wound up settling for parlay betting on NFL games. And I also found it kind of interesting that this could wind up being Chris Christie's most notable legacy, because New Jersey was the one, and he was kind of the driving force behind New Jersey challenging this. And getting the federal ban on sports betting nationwide struck down by the Supreme Court. What I'm really curious with you guys is that, you know, there's obviously this race now. All the states are trying to get it up and running as quickly as they can because they see revenue. Mm-hmm. And what does this say about the lure of perceived easy revenue to lawmakers to say, like, okay, sports betting's legal, let's do it, without really thinking perhaps about any of the possible unintended consequences of what you do?
I mean, I think probably there are consequences, right, for making gambling easier in general, however it's made easier, right? There's clear consequences. I think what lawmakers are thinking is that there are not clear political consequences, right? So while you get all this free revenue and you can use that to spend on whatever your pet project is, whatever your, you know, policy goal for the past few years has been, the consequences of gambling are probably not going to be directly linked to you the next time you face the voters. And so my guess is they see this as, you know, free money, completely free money.
And I think you bet on horses on trails, so no. I think that to me this is just like the next, you know, making money off of the next vice. I mean, we've been doing this for, you know, how long? And I think, you know, taxing cigarettes, we've seen, you know, the number of people who smoke cigarettes for a number of reasons going down over the years. So it's like
diminishing returns there.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So you got to find the next vice.
It is fascinating. And like I said, I'm kind of a geek about it. I'm curious to see how it's all going to work out here and how much money they actually do wind up pulling in.
Right.
Do want to finish up, as we always do, with, well, we were kind of joking the last time. It's a hot quick take or a quick hot take, however you want to take it. But something either lighthearted, a prediction, or something you feel kind of isn't getting the attention it deserves. Lindsay, we'll start with you.
Sure. Well, we just finished the semester here recently at the University of Delaware, and I give my students pop news quizzes throughout the semester. And typically, you know, at the end of the semester, I'll ask them, what was the most interesting, fascinating news story of the semester? That's actually on the last question on the last quiz of the semester. Hmm. So they get it right. They don't get it wrong, as long as it was a real story that happened. but it was a few years ago, and I can't remember what year this was, but the number one answer was the Bubble Boy. Do you remember this story?
Yes, I
remember
do.
The Bubble Boy.
What year was that? It was like 2013 or so, 14? I don't know. We'll have to look it up. But that was the story that everyone remembered from that semester, because there was live coverage of this bubble balloon thing floating through the air. Is there a boy in there or not? And then if you recall, the family appeared on, I think it was Good Morning America the next day.
Right.
And the little boy, I think, was so nervous from having experienced this whole trauma, and like they had lied about it. There's this whole drama behind it. And he, like, vomits on live television. So that was the big story. So imagine, okay, I'll ask you, what do you think was the most memorable, fascinating, interesting story of the semester from spring of 2018?
Wow, that's a good question.
I mean, every other day, actually every other 5 minutes, there was a story. So what do you think were the top two?
So wait, what do we think were the top two?
Or
what
do we
think the students
said? What do you think the students said?
Russia.
No.
So. Yeah. You see, I would have. My instinct before you started giving hints was Parkland, but
Parkland was number two.
I missed all the hints. Where were the hints?
I didn't drop any hints.
There was no hints.
There was like a story like every day, and I'm thinking, okay, well, there wasn't a story like every day with Parkland.
Oh, no. You were reading too much into what I was saying.
Well, okay.
I was saying
there's
a lot of.
I know Lindsay too well. I know to ignore things.
Oh, stop it. Oh, my goodness.
There's no hint dropping.
I am becoming like the joke of the podcast. No, I'm just kidding. Aw. No, it's Russia was in there, but it certainly wasn't in the top. Parkland and the March for Our Lives, those were definitely number two. We talked about them a lot this semester just because they kind of violated the typical issue attention cycle process. And number one was Stormy Daniels.
See, that was going to be my second.
I should have known. Yeah. That was something you talked about last podcast, and you were furious that they kept mentioning it. She's, you know.
Oh, yeah, that's right. They keep, like, we know what her job is.
Yeah.
We don't need to. No, that was the story that for them, they were really captivated by. And I have to say, it lessened my enthusiasm for their, being really engaged, because it's a soap opera story. And I think, you know, I don't know. They could have had many reasons for doing that. But that was clear. The clear winner was the Stormy Daniels story.
Huh.
Your turn, Phil.
Wow, I have nothing to top that. I was looking at the news, and I saw, right, there's this story about that maybe some of the tweets from Trump are not, in fact, from Trump, right, that his staffers or aides are sort of deliberately trying to mimic his
Trump voice.
His right. Trump voice, yeah, when sending out tweets. It's not super clear why they would do that. I mean, why not, I guess? But, I mean, his account has often tweeted things that seem to have different voices, different grammatical rules, and so on.
Wasn't there a study that showed, like, different voices from different accounts, like, different, like, the iPhone versus the...
Yeah, so sometimes his account tweeted from an iPhone, sometimes from an Android, and it was times of day as well. So times of day where his secretary was awake and at their job, the tweets were much more likely to be grammatically correct and sort of have punctuation in the right place. Tweets, I think for all of us, right, tweets outside of working hours were much more slapdash, which is definitely true for me. has nothing to do with my aides or assistants writing my tweets on my behalf. But I did want to highlight one poll from Gallup that I think there's a lot of attention about, you know, Trump's tweets. Just a quick reminder, vast majority of Americans are not on Twitter. So about one-fourth of Americans have a Twitter account. And according to Gallup, about 4% of the American public have a Twitter account, follow Donald Trump, and read his tweets. Hmm. And so, like, they get a lot of attention, right? And obviously, right, elites are following. The media, the journalists are clearly all following him and reading those tweets very carefully. The public is not in the slightest.
That, and most of the times they are engaging them more from when the news reports on what the tweet says and actually firsthand seeing the tweets themselves.
I think the comparable thing here might be when we started to see television news playing political ads as part of an ad watch and bringing more attention to the ads.
Than the ads themselves would garner themselves.
Right, exactly. So this is kind of, I mean, what's fascinating to me is to hear news people, you know, professional journalists read word for word Trump's tweets. But yeah, that's it's a few people who are seeing it directly on Twitter. But, you know, it'd be interesting to do a test of like just familiarity with issues that he brings up in his tweets and see how even people who aren't on Twitter, how familiar they are with those issues.
Yeah, and I think Gallup asked that, and about 2/3 of people said they'd been made aware of his tweets via other means.
Gotcha.
Right?
Fascinating.
So suddenly it reverberates out.
Sure.
Very, very interesting. See, that was good. You said you had nothing to follow with. You were wrong.
It was just less exciting. It's hard to follow Stormy Daniels.
Well, right? see, Lindsay's had practice at this. This is the third time around to have a quick hot take or a hot quick take. So,
well, and I,
you're getting good at it.
I was in radio in college. I was a DJ and I was a news director. So, you know, I got this.
I feel like I'm the amateur in the room.
Well, I will if you all feel you're embarrassed, I will say this to bring myself to the same level. When you talked about the Bubble Boy, is it weird that I thought like the Seinfeld episode about Bubble Boy first?
I know. Was it the Balloon Boy?
I don't remember the Seinfeld episode.
The story itself was the Balloon Boy.
I mean, everything.
Seinfeld's the Bubble Boy?
Yeah, everything goes back to Seinfeld.
There you go. Well, listen, thank you very much for joining us on this edition of the Midterm Matters podcast. Dr. Lindsay Hoffman, the Associate Director of the UD Center for Political Communication, and Dr. Phil Jones, Associate Professor from the UD Department of Political Science and International Relations. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
This was fun. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Midterm Matters podcast, produced by the University of Delaware Center for Political Communication and Delaware Public Media. For more on the UD Center for Political Communication's Midterm Matters National Agenda Series this fall, visit cpc.udel.edu.